Let's open up our Bibles to Isaiah. Isaiah 13 is where we're picking up tonight. And, you know, back in the 70s and in the early 80s, Pastor Chuck, when he was going through the Bible, it wouldn't be unheard of for him to do 10 chapters at a time. I sat through some of those 10-chapter Bible studies. And so I have precedence set by Pastor Chuck to go through 10 chapters tonight. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. Because these 10 chapters, chapter 13 through 23, they're chapters that really deal primarily with judgment. And specifically with the judgment of the surrounding nations and the great empires of the day. And so there's some, you know, there's some really beautiful statements in the midst of all the judgment, and we want to focus on those. But, you know, there's just a lot of parts of these chapters that are repetitious in regard to the judgment that's going to come and so forth. So, you know, we don't want to get bogged down in all of those details. It's unnecessary, but we do want to just get the overview of the judgments that are here. And as I mentioned before, so these are all prophetic statements about judgments that are to come. And remember that these judgments that are prophesied they're near in some cases. They're further out also. And then they're ultimately judgments that will come in the future. So there's at least two judgments on these various places that have already occurred. But there's one great judgment that has yet to come. And you can see that in the text because, you can see it on the one hand because the judgment is universal. And on the other hand, you can see it because the outcome is the full restoration and blessing of Israel. And so neither one of those things have happened, right? There's never been a universal judgment, except if you want to go back to the flood. But there's never been that, you know, final universal judgment upon rebellious mankind, nor has Israel ever entered into the fullness of God's blessing after they went through seasons of judgment. So they were sent off into captivity. They came back. The prophets talked about that. And there was a judgment on the nation and there was a blessing on them when they came back. But it was not a thorough judgment on the nation, nor was it a thorough blessing on the people. So much of what we look at tonight is going to be pointing us to the future. Because these nations that are mentioned here, although they, you know, they've had a long history alongside of the nation of Israel, they still have a history alongside of Israel. And when that final judgment comes down, it's going to include these various nations that are mentioned here. So chapter 13 begins with a pronouncement of judgment upon Babylon. A pronouncement concerning Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. Now, just remember that at this stage in history, Babylon is not yet a world power. At this time, at the time that Isaiah is writing, Assyria is the world power. Now, Assyria, the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire were very close to one another in many ways. And they were like city states that had gained worldwide dominion. And so, but at this time, although Babylon is a nation at this time and a significant nation, Assyria is the superpower. And so Babylon is not even going to rise to superpower status for over 100 years. So we see here, this is prophetic, but especially in this 13th chapter, it's going to become crystal clear that Babylon here, as it is in other places, is representative of the world, the whole world, and the system of the world that is in revolt against God. And so this pronouncement that comes from Isaiah, just read a couple of verses to start here. Lift up a banner on a barren mountain, call out to them, signal with your hand, and they will go through the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones. Yes, I have called my warriors who celebrate my triumph to execute my wrath. Listen, a commotion on the mountains like that of a mighty people. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms like nations being gathered together. The Lord of armies is mobilizing an army for war. They are coming from a distant land, from the farthest horizon, the Lord and the weapons of his wrath to destroy the whole country. Now, look at verse 6. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. So here's where it's taking on a universal scope. Therefore, everyone's hands will be weak. Every man will lose heart. They will be horrified. Pain and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look at each other, their faces flushed with fear. Look, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with rage and burning anger, to make the earth a desolation and to destroy its sinners. Indeed, the stars of the sky and its constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shine. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked people for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pride of the arrogant and humiliate the insolence of tyrants. I will make a human being more scarce than fine gold and mankind more rare than the gold of Ophir. So you can see the scope of this judgment is it's a universal judgment. It's the judgment that God is going to bring upon the world finally at some point in the future for its perpetual rebellion against him and for its rejection of his salvation through his son, Jesus, the Savior. And this is heavy stuff, obviously. I'm going to make a human being more rare than fine gold. Now, in the book of Revelation, which of course gives us a lot of detail about the judgment that will come, and chapter 18 of the book of Revelation refers to the judgment upon Babylon itself. And so that stands for the empires of the world. It also could possibly stand for a revived Babylon yet in the future. But here we see it's a fierce judgment that's going to come, and God is going to thin out the human race, really. And so therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, the earth will shake from its foundations at the wrath of the Lord of armies on the day of his burning anger. Now, jump down with me to verse 17. Look, the Lord speaking, I am stirring up the Medes against them being the Babylonians. So now here's where it goes back to the to Babylon itself in its ancient form. Babylon was conquered by the Medes and the Persians. So here's where you see a blending of the picture here and the scope of the prophecy going way out into the future, but then backing up again. And that, what I said in the beginning, that's the way it is with all of these judgments that are pronounced here all the way through chapter 23. That's the way it is on all of the various nations. The near judgment, the further distant judgment, and then the final judgment. So verse 19, and Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the glory of the pride of the Chaldeans will be like Sodom and Gomorrah. When God overthrew them, it will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. And then down in the last verse, Babylon's time is almost up. Her days are almost over. Now, this is interesting because notice the description of the destruction of Babylon. Babylon is going to be overthrown like Sodom and Gomorrah. What do we know about Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, from Genesis chapter 18, we see that Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed by fire and brimstone that God sent down from heaven, and the cities were completely consumed. Babylon was never destroyed in that fashion. Babylon faded out of history, really. It was conquered, the Babylonian empire was conquered by the Medes and the Persians, but they basically just took over the empire. They didn't destroy the city. The city remained. The city remained. It was a city in New Testament times. But finally, it just completely faded out of history. But because of this passage here in Isaiah and similar kinds of statements in Jeremiah, some have wondered about an actual literal rebuilding of Babylon at the end of time, in the final days before the Lord returns. And I think that is a possibility. Now remember where Babylon was. Babylon was in what we know today as Iraq. And actually before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Saddam Hussein was on a mission to rebuild Babylon. He actually had made some coins where he was depicting himself as the new Nebuchadnezzar. And not only that, but the UN was building, before all the war and everything broke out, the UN was working on a, not actually rebuilding the city, but turning a part of that area into a massive cultural center. And those things have all obviously been put on hold because of the ongoing wars in that region. But I think it's highly possible that Babylon itself could be rebuilt again in the future and could become very literally the place of commerce and trade and all of those things that Revelation chapter 18 talks about, where Revelation 18 actually uses the term Babylon. So that's speculation. I don't know that for sure. Some people think that could be the case. But if you consider how God says the city will be destroyed and the fact that it never was, but the picture of the destruction of Babylon in Revelation 18 is very much like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, because in one day, the great city is wiped out. So that might be in the future. We'll have to wait and see. So, chapter 14, for the Lord will have compassion on Jacob. So now all of this is tied to the Lord blessing Israel once he deals with Israel's enemies. God will have compassion on Jacob, will choose again Israel. He will settle them in their own land. The resident alien will join them and be united with the house of Jacob. The nations will escort Israel and bring it to its homeland. Then the house of Israel will possess them as male and female slaves in the Lord's land. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. So see, here's that promise of blessing and prosperity for Israel in the future that has not yet come in history. Now, verse 3, when the Lord gives you rest from your pain, torment, and the hard labor you were forced to do, you will sing this song of contempt about the king of Babylon. Now, the king of Babylon here. So this 14th chapter is it's a prophecy of judgment that's going to come upon the king of Babylon. And it begins, they're going to sing this song, how the oppressor has quieted down and how the raging has become quiet. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. And then he goes on in these next few verses to talk about how this king of Babylon is going to be overthrown. But then in verse 12, the prophet suddenly goes beyond the king of Babylon, the human ruler, and he addresses the spirit ruler behind the scenes. And this happens twice in the prophets. It happens here in Isaiah 14, and it also happens in Ezekiel 28. The king in Ezekiel 28 is the king of Tyre, which Tyre will come up in chapter 23 here. But in both places, you have a prophecy given against the human ruler, but then suddenly it looks beyond the ruler to the spiritual power behind the ruler. And so here is that passage here that in verse 12 reads, shining morning star, how have you fallen from the heavens? Now, remember, I'm reading the CSB, the Christian Standard Bible. If you have a New King James Version or a King James Version, verse 12 says, O Lucifer, how have you fallen from heaven? Now, the reason why the Bible I'm reading and the newer translations have dropped Lucifer is because Lucifer is the Latin translation of the Hebrew that means just what it says here, morning star. Now, Lucifer obviously has become like a, it's a proper name, but the Hebrew itself is not a proper name, but the Latin coming out as Lucifer, it sort of got tagged on as the proper name. So all of that to say, we commonly would talk about Satan and synonymously talk about Lucifer, and we would think of Satan's name as Lucifer, but it really isn't. That's the whole point that I'm making. It just says what it says here. It's addressed to the son of the morning. Now, another very interesting thing about this, the son of the morning is a title for Jesus. So this is where it has gotten kind of complicated for some people. And there's different theories about why this being is called the son of the morning. But some have speculated, and I think maybe there's something to it, that the being that we call Lucifer, remember, God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Michael is an archangel. His name is who is like God. Some have speculated that this being was directly submitted to and under the authority of the second person of the Trinity, and so had a name that reflected the name of the Lord. So whatever the case, we don't know, but here's what we see. We see a being now who's the power behind Babylon, a spiritual being who has fallen from the heavens, who at one time had a position in heaven, but has fallen from the heavens. And then it goes on, you destroyer of nations, you have been cut down to the ground. And so here's the process through which all of this happened. You said to yourself, I will ascend to the heavens. I will set up my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the God's assembly in the remotest parts of the north. I will ascend above the highest clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. So this is the description of how this being that we call Satan, this is how he came to be. So before, and Ezekiel goes into more detail about his previous position, before he is, actually Ezekiel says that he is God's highest creature. He's the sum of wisdom. He's perfect in beauty. There's no other creation like him, Ezekiel tells us. And so what Isaiah is describing here is this time in the past, and Jesus mentions it in Luke, I saw Satan fall from heaven as lightning, but this time in the past where he tries to usurp God's authority and place himself on the throne of God. So this is the coup that happened in heaven through this being. And so now it goes on and it says, so your plan was to be exalted and be like the Most High, but you will be brought down to Sheol, into the deepest regions of the pit. Now, verse 16, those who see you will stare at you. They will look closely at you. Is this the man who caused the earth to tremble and shook the kingdoms, who turned the world into a wilderness, who destroyed its cities, who would not release the prisoners to return home? All the kings of the nations lie in splendor, each in his own tomb, but you are thrown out without a grave, like a worthless branch covered by those slain with a sword and dumped in a rocky pit like a trampled corpse. So notice, so we actually have three people here. We have the king of Babylon that would come to power in 100 years. We have the power behind the king, who is the devil. And then we have this one who is visibly judged by all the world, who caused the world to shake and is now cast down and disgraced. This is the Antichrist. So that's what I'm talking about. You've got these different things happening in these prophecies. And so the Antichrist, of course, will be the visible human manifestation of this same power that was originally behind the king of Babylon when Isaiah wrote. And the judgment that will come upon the Antichrist is the one that's being referred to here, because it's clear that the person now being judged is a human being. And it's clear that the original king of Babylon did not do the kinds of things that this person did. As a matter of fact, you couldn't say, when you look at the judgment that's going to come on this person that's described here, that didn't happen to any of the Babylonian kings. It didn't happen to Nebuchadnezzar. Although Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, although Nebuchadnezzar was fierce and brutal, remember, Nebuchadnezzar had a conversion, and he wrote his story down. He wrote his testimony, and it's included in the book of Daniel. And then Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, who was in power at the time that the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon, we know his name. His name was Belshazzar. And we know that he didn't shake kingdoms and he didn't do all kinds of destructive things in the earth. And he didn't die this ignominious death either. He was slain in the palace of Babylon the night that the Medes and the Persians came in. So this is a, like I said, it's like a threefold prophecy, looking at the current monarchy of Babylon, looking at the power behind it, who is Satan, and then looking to the future at the power behind the person that we commonly call the Antichrist, or the beast is what the Bible refers to him as. And so you will not join them in burial. So the kings of the earth are all buried, you know, they have a noble burial, but not so with you, because you destroyed your land, slaughtered your own people. The offspring of evildoers will never be mentioned again. Prepare a place of slaughter, for his sons. Because of the iniquity of their fathers, they will never rise up to possess a land and fill the surface of the earth with cities. And so that is the promised destruction that will come upon Babylon. It came partially, and there's yet a distant fulfillment that is yet to come. Now, jumping down to verse 24, we move from Babylon now to Assyria. And remember, at the time now that we're reading this, or at the time that this is written, Assyria is the power. And so now God says, I will break Assyria in my land. I will tread him down on my mountain. Now, when we get to chapter 39 of Isaiah, we're going to see the fulfillment of this prophecy right here. God breaks the power of Assyria in Israel. That's how Assyria is pretty much defeated. God destroys a large amount of their military, and then their king Sennacherib is shortly after that. He's murdered by his own sons, and then the spiral begins for Assyria. But we'll read about that when we get there. So we move from the judgment pronounced on Assyria to now a pronouncement of judgment against Philistia. And so in verse 28, in the year that King Ahaz died, this pronouncement came. So remember the kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz. Ahaz was the really wicked king that we talked about last time. And now the other king during the reign of Isaiah is going to be Hezekiah. And so this is now entering into the reign of Hezekiah because Ahaz died in this year. And so there's a pronouncement of judgment upon Philistia. Philistia is the land of the Philistines, which would be the southern coastal area of Israel. So like, for example, the Gaza Strip, that whole area we hear about Gaza on the news today, that was Philistine country. Ashdod, which is now an Israeli port, that was a Philistine city as well. So there's going to be a judgment that will come upon Philistia, and which did come. Then from there, chapter 15 is a pronouncement concerning Moab. Now Moab, if you were to go to the city of Jericho, or if you were to stand on the Mount of Olives on a clear day and look to the east, you could see on a clear day, you can see into what is today Jordan. And what is today Jordan used to be Ammon, Moab, and Edom. So those three nations made up what we know today as Jordan. So when we're talking about Moab, we're talking about that region directly east of Judah. Judah would have been the geographical location where Jerusalem is and Bethlehem and those places. So directly east there, just on the other side of the Dead Sea, that would be Moab. And so the judgment is going to come upon Moab. Ar in Moab is devastated, destroyed in a night. Kir in Moab is devastated, destroyed in a night. Dibon went to its temple, up to its temple to weep in the high places. Moab wails on Nebo at Medebah, and every head is shaved. And so these places, actually a few years ago, we went to Mount Nebo. You can go to Mount Nebo. And you can stand on Mount Nebo today and you can look across across the Jordan and across the you're at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, and you can see the land from the viewpoint of Moses. That's where Moses viewed the land. And then some of these cities that are mentioned here, Medebah is a city, is a part of what is modern day Ammon in Jordan. And so this is the judgment that would come upon those lands. But now remember, these lands are all still living in relative disapproval of Israel. And even though there's some negotiating going on, there's some talks about we should try to get along with our Israeli neighbors and all of that, you know, which is, it's good. But that will not last, because all of these surrounding countries, although they've been through various judgments, they will be the ones that will all be part of the final judgment when God brings that about. So the 15th chapter and the 16th chapter largely deal with Moab. But let's jump over to chapter 16, and I want to pick up in I'll pick up in verse 3. Give us counsel and make a decision. Shelter us at noonday with shade that is as dark as night. Hide the refugees. Do not betray the one who flees. Let my refugees stay with you. Be a refuge for Moab from the aggressor. When the oppressor has gone, destruction has ended, and marauders have vanished from the land, here's a prophecy, a throne will be established in love. And one will sit on it faithfully in the tent of David, judging and pursuing what is right, quick to execute judgment. So in the middle of this prophecy about the judgment that's going to come upon Moab, suddenly there's a prophecy of a throne that's established in love, set up in the tent of David. So suddenly there's a messianic prophecy in the middle of this. And as we're going to see in just a moment, God has a plan for these surrounding nations. And you know, it's interesting when you think about it, when you study the Bible, if we did start in Genesis, it's been a while ago, but if you go back to Genesis and you start and you're reading through, these lands, like Moab, for example, remember, the Moabites and the Ammonites were the descendants of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. So there's all this relational stuff that's happens here. There's all of this connection back to the patriarchs and things. So what we're going to see here in a moment is that God has a plan in the future to include these nations, to bring these people into a relationship with himself. Now, the rest of chapter 16 is just continuing on with the prophecy about the judgment of Moab. And then we come to chapter 17, and now we have a pronouncement against Damascus. Now, a pronouncement concerning Damascus. Look, Damascus is no longer a city. It has become a ruined heap. The cities of Aroer are abandoned. They will be places for flocks. They will lie down without fear. The fortress disappears from Ephraim and a kingdom from Damascus. The remnant of Aram will be like the splendor of the Israelites. This is a declaration of the Lord of armies. So again, you have two things going on here, because remember, Damascus and Ephraim had a covenant with each other. That was the one we read about last week, where Ahaz is fearful because these two powers have come up against Judah, and God says, don't worry about it. You know, within 65 years, this whole thing's going to be completely over, and within just a few years, they're going to break their allegiance with each other. So it's referring to that time there, but then it also goes out, and the amazing thing, notice, the remnant of Aram, which would be the peoples of Damascus in that region, will be like the splendor of the Israelites. So God's going to do a work among these people. Now, Damascus is an interesting case in point. You know, they say that Damascus is the oldest city in the world. I don't know if you know that or not. It's the oldest continuous city in the world. Remember, back in the time of Abraham, Abraham had a servant named Eliezer. Eliezer was from Damascus. And so you have references to Damascus all the way back. And, you know, you might think Jerusalem is probably, you know, a close competitor with that, and it might very well be. But so they say Damascus is the oldest city in the world. So from the time of Abraham till today, Damascus has always existed as some form of a city. But here is a prophecy that Damascus will one day be judged. But then there's also the promise that God's going to turn the splendor of Aram like the children of Israel. So it doesn't seem that it's going to be a permanent destruction. And the reason I bring that up is because some look at this particular passage and they think, well, you know, the stuff that's going on in Syria these days, and Damascus, of course, is the big city there in Syria. Whenever there's conflict with the Israelis and the Syrians, or whenever the Russians are doing something pertaining to Syria, people will talk about, well, Damascus is going to be destroyed. Isaiah 17 is going to be fulfilled. And, you know, that might be possible, but it might have been a reference to the past, and it might even be a reference perhaps to the time when the Antichrist comes. So some of these things we just don't know. And to make a dogmatic statement about it is just not, I don't think it's the wisest way to approach it. It's interesting, but we don't really know what's going to happen. So chapter 17, as we go on here, it's talking about the judgment that's coming upon. But then it says this in verse 7, on that day, people will look to their maker and will turn their eyes to the Holy One of Israel. So as I said, some of these judgments, I think, are future. And it's the time when the Antichrist is in power, but it's also the time when people will look to the Lord. And so it says here, in that day, people will look to the Lord. Then as we go over to chapter 18, we have now a message concerning Cush. Woe to the land of buzzing insect wings, beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by sea in reed vessels over the waters. Go swift messengers to a nation tall and smooth-skinned, to a people feared far and near, a powerful nation with a strange language whose land is divided by rivers. Now, the land of Cush is also sometimes referred to as Ethiopia. And the problem for us today is the Ethiopia of Bible times is not the Ethiopia of today. So this area that's being talked about here is probably what used to be called Nubia. And Nubia is a southern, southeastern part of Egypt and the northeastern part of what we know today as Sudan. And so northern Sudan would be probably more the area that's being referred to here. And notice the description of the people. They're smooth-skinned and they're tall. The Sudanese are tall. And they very smooth skin still to this day. And so I think that if we want to identify the place geographically, that's the area that we're talking about here. Now, in the prophecy of Ezekiel, where it talks about the different nations that are going to be aligned together and they're going to come against Israel, Persia is in there. And interestingly, Ethiopia is in there as well. And that would be Sudan. But an interesting thing that's happening in northern Sudan right now, northern Sudan has been under Islamic rule for centuries and a pretty hard Islamic rule. And yet, as of the past couple of years, there's been a revolution that's taken place, and they've pretty much removed the hardcore Islamic government. And they basically want to have more of a secular government. They want to just have a government where they can, you know, build their lives. People can be religious, but they don't have to be religious. And if you want to be a Christian or a Jew or something else, you're not going to be persecuted for it. And I was talking with a friend from Sudan the other day, and he was telling me that it's really amazing what has happened there in recent times. And, you know, they've even said, like, we don't want to be against Israel. We don't want to be all caught up in this Islamic worldview. We want to just live our lives and do our best to enjoy ourselves while we can. So the interesting things happening in the whole area of the Middle East today. And so, you know, this is the way it is when it comes to the Middle East. And this is what we who believe in Bible prophecy have to be aware of and therefore careful about. We have to be aware that things change all the time there. And the mistake that sometimes Christians make is, you know, something happens and then immediately we say, oh, well, that's this. This is a fulfillment right here in the Bible. It says this, and look at that's happening right there. That's what that's about. But then a few years later, it's completely different. It all changed. So then you're back to the drawing board going, wait a second. I thought that was going to be this. So it's wiser, I think, to recognize that absolutely there's Bible prophecy and some things we can know a fair amount of detail about because God gives it to us. But other things we don't know. We don't know exactly how all of this is going to roll out. I mean, at one time we were absolutely convinced that Gog and Magog, Russia, and Russia was going to attack Israel and all of that because of the Soviet Union. We knew that. We preached that. And then the Soviet Union, it melted down, went out of existence. But then in its place, all these Islamic countries came back into a position of prominence. Islam was on the decline. In the early part of the 20th century, there were predictions that Islam would just cease to be a religion. It was going to just die. But it didn't. It revived. And suddenly, people were thinking, oh, wait a second. Wait, we thought it was the Russians. Maybe it's these Islamic nations, this confederation here. And we thought the Antichrist was going to come out of Europe. Oh, maybe he's going to be a Muslim. So these are the things that people, start to speculate about because they've been speculating about other things. And so all of that to say, we need to be careful not to try to get more specific than God has and to recognize there are gaps in our knowledge. And so things that are clear, we can go with it. It's clear that in the end of time, God's going to bring Israel back to the land. And I personally would hold to this position myself, that the only clear prophecy that's been fulfilled regarding Israel is that one right there, that they have been brought back to the land. Everything else is, I think, up for debate. But that one, I think, is absolutely certain. That has happened. But Ezekiel said they would come back to the land, but they would be there without a spirit. Because remember, he gave the picture of that valley of dry bones, and the dry bones were going to come together and form a body, and the body was going to have the sinew and the muscle and the skin and everything, but then it's going to be lying there breathless. And my opinion is that's Israel today. They're breathless. They're without the Spirit of God. And everything's waiting for that to happen, but that will happen in the future. So, enough of that. But back in 18, once again, just in verse 7, it's a short chapter here, but verse 7, at that time, a gift will be brought to the Lord of armies from a people tall and smooth skin, a people feared far and near, a powerful nation with a strange language whose land is divided by the rivers, to Mount Zion, to the place of the name of the Lord of armies. So this people is going to come and worship the Lord. But now we come to chapter 19. And chapter 19 is even more fascinating because chapter 19 is a pronouncement of judgment against Egypt. And we're not going to go into all of the details of the judgment here. So the first part, most of it has already happened in Egyptian history. But there's still future things. And so let's pick up in verse 16. And this is so fascinating here. It says this, on that day, so this day in the future, Egypt will be like a woman and will tremble with fear because of the threatening hand of the Lord of armies when he raises it against them. The land of Judah will terrify Egypt. Whenever Judah is mentioned, Egypt will tremble because of what the Lord of armies has planned against it. On that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and swear loyalty to the Lord of armies. One of the cities will be called the City of the Sun. So there's coming a day when God's going to bring a judgment on Egypt, and the end result is that Egypt is going to worship the Lord. They're going to speak the language of Canaan. You know, the Egyptians speak Arabic today. That's not the ancient Egyptian language. That language doesn't exist. But they speak Arabic, and that's the influence of Islam on them. But the passage here says they're going to speak the language of Canaan. What was the language of Canaan? It was Hebrew. So the Egyptians are going to speak Hebrew in the future. That's pretty fascinating. But look at this, verse 19. On that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the center of the land of Egypt and a pillar to the Lord near her border. It will be a sign and a witness to the Lord of armies in the land of Egypt. When they cry out to the Lord because of their oppressors, he will send them a savior and leader, and he will rescue them. Wow. So this, again, we don't know for sure, but this seems to be referring to Egypt coming under the dominion of the Antichrist, but Jesus coming as their deliverer and delivering them from that oppression. And then it says in verse 21, the Lord will make himself known to Egypt, and Egypt will know the Lord on that day. Isn't that amazing? The Egyptians are going to know the Lord. I mean, let's think back to Egypt. This is the place where the Israelites were in captivity. This is where Pharaoh was. This is where Moses came. This is where, Egypt was destroyed by the judgment of God. The Passover took place. They crossed the Red Sea. And now Egypt will know the Lord. On that day, they will offer sacrifices and offerings. They will make vows to the Lord and fulfill them. The Lord will strike Egypt, striking and healing. Then they will turn to the Lord, and he will be receptive to their prayers and heal them. Wow. Amazing. But now, this is even more amazing. Look at verse 23. On that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Assyria will go to Egypt, Egypt to Assyria, and Egypt will worship with Assyria. On that day, Israel will form a triple alliance with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing within the land. The Lord of armies will bless them, saying, Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance are blessed. Wow, that is amazing. I mean, that is so astounding when you think of it. But think of this. There are 1 billion Muslims in the world. And I think what this is telling us is that there's going to come a time when the eyes of these Muslims are going to be open to the true God. Because these are Islamic countries, right? I mean, Assyria is Iraq, and Egypt is Egypt. But if you think about these multitudes of Muslims, who have a false religion, but if you've ever read the Quran or if you've ever, you know, studied Islam, you realize that they took so much from the scriptures and just added their own ideas and myths and so forth to it. But, you know, there's enough in there to even to this day where people reading the Quran will come to faith sometimes because of looking at what it says about Jesus. But think about it, when they're under the oppression of the Antichrist, it just seems like this would be the time when their eyes are opened to the true God. And so they then become the people of God. But this passage has always absolutely fascinated me, and not me only, but many, many people. So Egypt, Assyria, my handiwork, Israel, my inheritance. And there's going to be like a highway. Hey, let's go worship the Lord in Assyria. All right, let's get on the road. Let's head over to Assyria to worship the Lord. Now we're going to go to Egypt. We're going to worship the Lord there. Well, we're going to go to Israel. And there's this, they're all united in the worship of the Lord. That's the future. That's awesome. So chapter 20, this again now is going back. In the year that the chief commander sent by King Sargon of Assyria came to Ashdod and attacked and captured it, during that time the Lord had spoken through Isaiah, son of Amos, saying, here's a funny prophecy or a funny direction from the Lord. Go take off your sackcloth and remove the sandals from your feet. And he did that, going stripped and barefoot. The Lord said, as my servant Isaiah has gone stripped and barefoot 3 years as a sign and an omen against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will be led captive to Egypt, lead the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Cush, young and old alike, stripped and barefoot with bare buttocks to Egypt's shame. Those who made Cush their hope and Egypt their boast will be dismayed and ashamed. And the inhabitants of this coast land will say on that day, look, this is what happened to those who relied on and fled for help to rescue from the king of Assyria. Now, how will we escape? So Isaiah is given this order by God to walk around with his buttocks revealed and barefoot. And it's a prophecy. Today we were talking about, with our pastor staff, we were talking about today, you know, as we move into the ministry of the Spirit, and, you know, there can be some weird things that happen. But one of them will not be people with a bare buttocks, barefooted prophesying. So we're sure that that is not what God has planned for us. So chapter 21, we're back to a judgment again upon Babylon. And so we'll just move past that. 11, verse 11, a pronouncement concerning Duma. Duma seems to be Edom. So another name for Edom. Seir was part of Edom, so one calls to me from Seir. And then watchmen, what is left of the night, watchmen, what is left of the night. The watchman says, morning has come and also night. Every time I read this passage, it's really, I always think about this because there was a very famous man back in the 1800s who was a scholar. And he wrote some great books. His name is Alfred Edersheim. And he wrote a great, great book called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. Probably one of the greatest volumes ever on the life of Jesus from the standpoint of, from a Jewish understanding. He was an Orthodox Jew as a boy, but then came to faith, became a scholar, was a scholar at Oxford University. And anyway, he wrote this great, fantastic book. He wrote a number of books, and I've always loved his books. But in the the cover page to the life and times of Jesus the Messiah, this is the verse that he has in there. And in the King James, it reads, "Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night?" And then it says, "The morning comes and also the night." And he put it in there because he saw in it the prophecy of the future for Israel back at the time that the watchman called out, "The morning is coming." That would be the birth of the Messiah, but also the night. And that would be the long history of Israel in their exile from God. So every time I read this verse, I think of that there in that great volume by Edersheim. So chapter 22, there's a pronouncement against Arabia that is mentioned here. And the Arabia here, Saudi Arabia is a little bit of a different place, but it's in the same area. This is more in the northern part. But anyway, there's a prophecy here against that northern region of Arabia. And then we come to the 22nd chapter. And the 22nd chapter is dealing again with Jerusalem. So it's speaking of judgment that's going to come upon Jerusalem. One thing to note, just if you want to highlight it, I have it highlighted. Verse 13, "But look, joy and gladness, butchering of cattle, slaughtering of sheep and goats, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." You might remember that Paul quotes that in his letter to the Corinthians there in verse 13. But then down in verse 15, we have this this person named Shebna. "And so the Lord God of armies said, 'Go to Shebna, the steward who is in charge of the palace, and say to him,'" I'm not going to read all of it. It just get down to verse 19. "Say to him," basically, "'you are disgraced to the house of your Lord, and I will remove you from your office. You will be ousted from your position.'" So this is a person who was in the position of being like the prime minister at the time. Now, the problem is that Shebna appears at this time in different contexts, and he always appears in a favorable light, even though there's not much detail. He's the one that goes out when Sennacherib comes and all of this. So there's a big kind of a confusion among Bible scholars about, is this the same Shebna? Is it a different person? How do we understand this? Was he at one time, you know, serving God, but then he became lifted up with pride? Who knows? We don't really know. But just thought I would mention it, even though there really isn't an answer to it. It could very well be the same person. But here's the passage that we want to just look at really quickly. Verse 20, "On that day," so Shebna's going to be removed, "on that day I will call for my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe," he's speaking to Shebna, "and tie your sash around him. I will hand your authority over to him, and he will be like a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah." So Shebna's going to be removed, and Eliakim is going to take the place of the prime minister. And listen to this, though, verse 22, "I will place the key of the house of David on his shoulder. What he opens, no one can close, and what he closes, no one can open." Does that sound familiar to you? Jesus said this in his word to the church in Revelation. I think it's Philadelphia. That "I have the key of David. I open, no one can close. I close and no one can open." So that's obviously a reference back to this passage right here where God is giving authority to Eliakim. And so Jesus, of course, would be the ultimate. He has ultimate authority because he is the king over the house of David. So, and then it just goes on to speak about Eliakim, and he's going to be a blessing for a certain point of time, but then that's going to pass, and then things are going to become difficult again for Jerusalem. And then chapter 23 is a prophecy regarding Tyre. Now, Tyre, remember in the Gospels, we hear about Tyre and Sidon. We hear about Phoenicia. Lebanon today is that area. And Tyre was a great city, a coastal city, but it was also an island off the coast. And the Phoenicians were famous for, they were seafarers, and they were famous for trading on the seas and for shipbuilding and all of those kinds of things. It's the king of Tyre, remember what I said earlier, that the Ezekiel 28 passage prophesies against and then goes into the power behind the king of Tyre. And so this 23rd chapter is a pronouncement against Tyre. And there's some things that that nobody really knows. There's verse 17 talks about a 70-year period. Nobody really knows what happened at that time. But Tyre was finally conquered by Alexander the Great and then by the Romans as well. So we go from there, and when we come now to the next chapters, we're looking at judgment, but now the next chapters are looking at universal judgment and not speaking specifically of these nations, but speaking about a judgment that's going to come upon the whole world. So, but there's also some wonderful promises of salvation in the midst of that too. So that's where we will pick up next week, chapter 24. So Lord, thank you for the opportunity to go through your word together. Thank you for the amazing things that you've done and the amazing things that you are going to do. And Lord, thank you that one day, the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Israelites will all worship you together. And we will all worship you together. Because as we read earlier, the earth will be covered. The earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the seas are covered with water. And Lord, we long for that day. We thank you that as we look at your word and we look at the world, even though we might not know the finer details of some of these prophecies, we see in the big picture that you are moving and that things are going exactly the way you said they would go. And so, Lord, if that's true of nations that don't know you, that is especially true of your church and of us, your people who do know you. And so thank you that you are guiding our lives. And we give our lives into your hand once again tonight for your guidance. Speak to us, and may we take away tonight just a nugget or two, a word of encouragement from your spirit. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.